Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 845, interview number 8 with Peter LaVenda about the Hitler legacy. This is being recorded on April 26th of the year 2015. Once again, it is my pleasure and my privilege to bring back to our airwaves Peter LaVenda, the author of, among other titles, The Hitler Legacy, the focal point of the discussion we're about to have, and the last 7 programs, and at least one more. Peter, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here as always.
And it would be impossible to sum up the first 7 hours of our discussions. Suffice it to say, as I have mentioned a number of times in these interviews, with the exception of The Secret War Against the Jews by John Loftus and Mark Arons, Dreamer of the Day by Kevin Coogan, and The Beast Reawakens by Martin Lee, there has never been a single volume with as many of the different topics that I talk about between the covers, and indeed the others might not measure up under the circumstances. They are all worth reading, and I noticed they were also in your bibliography, Peter, but this is a remarkable book, and for those listeners that have been following this work, or for all of you, relatively new listeners, and those of you who have been following this work for the decades that I have been on the air, please go out and get this book. I have no financial stake in this whatsoever. However, over the decades, I've discussed these things episodically, and now an awful lot of the material that I have spoken of is between 2 covers, and remarkably, it's not even that long a book. So at the end, we'll talk about where you can get the book. Of course, the usual suspects are there. Now, Peter, we were talking in our last interview about things going on in Indonesia and the remarkable Nazi presence in Indonesia. Before we return to Sukarno's gold, the Revolutionary Fund, the Golden Lily loot that was stashed in the Philippines and in Indonesia, near the end of the program last week, we talked about the apparent role in an unsuccessful 1958 coup to unseat Sukarno. He was finally successfully deposed in a bloody coup in 1965, but a young Marine Corps, I believe he was a private at the time, Lee Harvey Oswald was eventually, was apparently involved in that coup attempt. But briefly detail that for us, if you would.
Certainly. I think most listeners are aware that Lee Harvey Oswald was in the Marines in the 1950s. He had studied Russian during the time that he was in the Marines, something that's kind of unusual. He seemed to have a proficiency at it. But as one thing led to another, he wound up working at Atsugi Air Base in Japan, which was where the U-2 overflights were launched against the Soviet Union. But in 1958, there was a massive military buildup in the Philippines in preparation for a possible invasion of Indonesia. The reason given for this was to overthrow President Sukarno of Indonesia, who was perceived as being a communist-leaning dictator. He was notably working with, in some form or another, the PKI, which stands for the Communist Party of Indonesia. And there was this belief that ever since the Bandung Conference of 1955, when Sukarno mentioned the idea that the non-aligned nations should get together and form a bloc against both the United States and the Soviet Union, it was perceived that Sukarno was tilting towards China, was heavily involved with the Chinese communists in Indonesia, and was thinking of putting Indonesia within the sphere of influence in China. Therefore, in 1958, you had this a large buildup. You had something like 40,000 troops that were being readied for a possible invasion of Indonesia should the military coup against Sukarno prove successful, and should the new rulers, the military rulers, then ask the United States for support in putting down the communist insurgents, we would have the troops ready and available at the time. So that's the context. This is the Cold War, 1958, more or less the height of the Cold War. Everyone suspicious of everyone else. And one thing we tend to forget when we think of the Cold War, we think of Russia, We think of Vienna. We think of the spy networks operating out of Vienna and Germany into East Germany and Eastern Europe. We forget that the Cold War also took place in Asia, and that China was considered as big a threat as the Soviet Union to, quote-unquote, capitalism, democracy, world peace, whatever you want to call it. Therefore, anyone who was siding with the communists in Asia had to be stopped. Hence, we would eventually get involved in Vietnam. We had advisors in Laos. We had people in Malaysia and Singapore. There were operations in place all over Asia to counter effect any kind of political machinations by the Chinese. And this is about the time also we mentioned previously that General Willoughby, General MacArthur's quote-unquote pet fascist, was giving testimony before the House Un-American Activities Committee regarding Indonesia, saying that Indonesia was in danger of going communist and that what we should do is make of Indonesia a kind of buffer with the rest of Southeast Asia against China to protect Australia and New Zealand. So this is the context of this. Tensions were extremely high, and according to Fletcher Prouty, who wrote letters regarding this particular instance, he believed that Oswald was part of the military contingent waiting in the Philippines, and we do know that Oswald was in the Philippines. He did serve in the Philippines during his stint in Asia, in Japan as well. So it's not as far-fetched as we might think.
I'd like to return to Oswald and some of his apparent Nazi connections. It was actually that connection that first brought me to this dance, so to speak. Before that, however, somebody who does not receive a lot of attention in the Hitler legacy, and yet someone, I think, whose appointment exemplifies some of the political and historical dynamics that you talk about with Nazism in South Asia and Indonesia in particular, and that is a guy named Dr. Hilmar Bassler, B-A-S-S-L-E-R. I wonder if you would briefly detail that, and then we'll return to the subject of Lee Harvey Oswald.
Certainly. Dr. Hilmar Bassler, in 1968, had been appointed by the West German government as the ambassador to Indonesia, which is a very interesting selection because Bassler, during World War II, had been a member of the Gestapo, as well as of the SD, the Secret Service, the Nazi Secret Service. This was a man who was very tightly connected into the Third Reich and into the ideology of the Third Reich. When you were in the Gestapo and in the SD, you were one of the true believers. You were the Gestapo stands for secret police, Geheimstaatspolizei, and that's what you were. You were part of the not the regular police functionary, but the secret police, the ideological police. And this was Bassler's involvement during the war. The post-war German governments, the string of German governments that happened in the late 1940s, 50s, and 60s, were notorious for the fact that they hired many former Nazis as members of government. Their excuse was, well, the entire German nation had been involved in the war. It was almost impossible to find people who had not been involved in these things. How could we run a country without former Nazis? That was the narrative. However, we're talking about a relatively small handful of individuals who were members of Gestapo, members of the SS, members of the SD, who found themselves in positions of prominence in the various governments that that took place since the end of the war. So this was partly the result of the Gehlen organization. Reinhard Gehlen, of course, was an intelligence chief, a general, who then was denazified, quote-unquote, by the Americans, and put in charge of anti-Soviet espionage activities. Eventually, Gehlen became the head of West German intelligence. So here we have a prominent Nazi, someone responsible indirectly, at least, for all sorts of war crimes that took place in the occupied territories, who then becomes head of intelligence for the West German government. And in that position is able to get friends of his, cronies and fellow travelers, positioned in places of importance and critical nexus of government and politics in Germany. So you have someone like Bassler with an extraordinarily strange background being appointed ambassador to Indonesia in 68. 1968 was 3 years after the coup against President Sukarno, the successful one in 1965. Sukarno was put under house arrest, and the generals, notably Suharto, who became president, were now in charge. These were anti-communist fanatics. These were people who were the Indonesian version of fascists, and they were now in charge of the country. And it was considered appropriate, I suppose, that Basler would be sent there. And Basler's introduction, we might say, to the Indonesian people was as he landed in Indonesia and was on his way in his official car to take up his residence in Jakarta, his car ran over a small child and killed the small child in the process. This was only a taste of things to come. Basler was extremely unpopular to the rank-and-file Indonesians. He was extremely dictatorial. He was a person who maintained his sort of Gestapo-like sensibilities, even in this post in Jakarta. And oddly enough, he also somehow was involved with the United States government, as well as the Republic of Germany. We find him, as I mentioned, in the Hitler legacy, during the Vietnam War. We find him in Vietnam being briefed on the Strategic Hamlet program. The Strategic Hamlet program could be considered part of the Phoenix operation in Vietnam. Strategic Hamlets were those hamlets that were identified as being possible concentrations of Viet Cong or Viet Cong sympathizers. They had to clean out certain hamlets. They had to, quote-unquote, de-communist them, make them free zones for American forces and for the local South Vietnamese forces to operate within. It was an idea of trying to create a kind of cordon sanitaire around the enemy. So basically, this was the strategic Hamlet program was kind of a fig leaf for what was actually being taken, what was actually taking place in Vietnam as part of Operation Phoenix, which was an assassination program. It was a mind control, psychological warfare operation, et cetera, et cetera. So Basler somehow, as part of the Federal Republic of Germany, as part of the German government, is being briefed on this in Vietnam. It's only a brief mention buried deeply within some files on the Vietnam War, some microfilm files. It's with some labor that I was able to extract that particular microfilm record, and I give the location in Hitler Legacy. I can't really figure out what was going on with Basler, just that he was very well connected, had a lot of juice, both with the German government and with our own.
Returning again to the subject of Lee Harvey Oswald, of course, the American historical record has it that he was a lone nut, and yet, even to this day, there is material, really disinformation being floated that he was a communist, that he had ties to Cuba, had defected to the Soviet Union with top secret information about our radar defense nets. And yet, when one studies the record of Lee Harvey Oswald, one comes across people from the exact opposite side of the political aisle, are being handled by white Russians, white Ukrainians, people from the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations. And as you point out in the Hitler Legacy, people from the American Nazi Party, people in his family's orbit from the Seekerites, and even some prominent eugenicists. I wonder if you would fill us in on that.
Certainly. There's a I think what got me involved in this particular investigation where Oswald is concerned, since everyone and his brother has done the Kennedy assassination and they've investigated Oswald, and I thought there was no more to be learned about Lee Harvey Oswald when I started this. But I came across a bizarre reference in Oswald's curriculum vitae, we might say. In 1960, Oswald applies to a bizarre little-known college in Switzerland called the Albert Schweitzer College, named after, of course, the famous Dr. Albert Schweitzer. This is a college which is in a very, very tiny town, or was in a very small town in Switzerland, in the Alps, a town that numbered no more than 500 people at any given time, a university or a college that only numbered about 50 students at any given time. Virtually nothing is known about this college. Nothing was known. It was not prominent on the list of universities that Americans would apply to during the normal course of events. And yet we have Lee Harvey Oswald not only applying to Albert Schweitzer College in the Alps, sending in $25 fee to be accepted into the university. It doesn't sound like much today, but in 1959, when he sent in that check, that was a lot of money, especially for Oswald, who had no visible means of support. And he is accepted by the university, and they have a place set out for him, and they're waiting for him to show up. What was that all about? This is something that nobody really ever focuses on or talks about, and yet he finds this university somehow. This was in the days before the Internet, before Google, before personal computers. All you had in those days was, if you were lucky, the Yellow Pages. And somehow Oswald found this university, wrote to them, and was accepted, even though his academic credentials were virtually non-existent. He's accepted. He says he wants to study German. Okay. Well, he takes off from the United States, ostensibly to go to Switzerland to take up his residence as a freshman at the university, at the basic college level as an undergrad. He never winds up there. He never shows up in Switzerland after his $25 and after his acceptance and after sending the letter and everything else you're supposed to do. Instead, he winds up in Helsinki, and he's on his way to the Soviet Union and to Moscow, and the rest is history. This begs a number of questions. The first question is, if Oswald was indeed this lone gunman that he's been put out, made out to be, how is he being so sly, we might say, as to develop this paper trail for himself, which would indicate that he was really on his way to Switzerland to go to school, which is why he left the U.S. and went into Europe? Was that the reason? Was he trying to throw some disinformation out there to make people look in the wrong direction? Or was this all part of one single plan that Oswald was working on? Of course, at this late stage, we don't know. But as we start to put in the other pieces of the puzzle together, a picture does begin to emerge. Because after the assassination, Oswald's address book comes into the possession of the authorities. And in this address book, we find not only some rudimentary German vocabulary that he was working on, but also we find the address of the American Nazi Party, we find the name of George Lincoln Rockwell, and we find the name of Dan Burroughs, including his address in Queens, New York, at the time when Dan Burroughs was running the American Nazi Party from that location. Conspiracy theorists want to make something out of this, and the people who are poo-pooing the whole idea of a conspiracy are trying to say, well, Oswald was just accumulating information. He was interested in fringe groups or something like that. Again, if we put together the rest of the pieces, this is not very likely. Oswald had something in mind. He had some plan in mind. As you mentioned, he was thick and thin with the white Russians in Texas, with George de Morenschild, who was a very prominent part of that milieu. We had, as we will talk about in the address book, another prominent eugenicist was mentioned in Lee Harvey Oswald's address book, name, address, phone number, his wife's name. All of this was accumulated by Lee Harvey Oswald, found in his address book after his death. Dan Burroughs was a unique individual. He was Jewish. For a Jew to then become the head of the American Nazi Party or to run an aspect of it out of Queens seems counterintuitive. Burroughs was obviously hiding the fact that he was Jewish. He was a rabid Nazi in the style of George Lincoln Rockwell. And when newspaper reporters uncovered the fact that he was Jewish and were publishing this in the newspapers, Burroughs went to a house in Reading, Pennsylvania, and committed suicide on Halloween. The house where he committed suicide was owned by a man called Roy Frankhauser. Roy Frankhauser, known by his nom de guerre as Riot Roy, was a prominent Klansman, member of the Ku Klux Klan, as well as a member of various Nazi party organizations. And I met personally Roy Frankhauser years after the suicide of Dan Burroughs at his home in Reading, where this had taken place. And this was in concert with James Madole and other members of the National Renaissance Party, which was a neo-Nazi party organization in the United States for many years after the war. So we had James Madole, Roy Frankhauser in this building where Dan Burroughs had committed suicide. Somehow Oswald was linked into all of this. And once again, I hasten to point out, This is long before there was an internet. This is long before there were Google searches. You have to be really conscientious to develop these kinds of connections and to write down this information and to covet, you might say, this data, because it was very hard to come by for the average person in those days. So with the address book, we find that he knew or was familiar with, let's put it that way, the American Nazi Party, individuals within the Nazi Party. He also knew and personally seemed to have been aware of a man called Henry Warner Klepfer. Klepfer was a eugenicist. He was a very prominent eugenicist. I've come across articles that he wrote in the 1930s, 1940s, in 1950s regarding eugenics. He was one of those who believed in racial purity, let's say, or in cleaning up the human race and getting rid of defective elements within the race. He was also, he and his wife lived in New Orleans in a home that was owned by Clay Shaw. Now, Clay Shaw, as I think many of you remember, was the only person ever taken to court where the Kennedy assassination was concerned, taken to court by Jim Garrison, the attorney general in New Orleans, the district attorney in New Orleans. The Clay Shaw trial was made famous, of course, by the film JFK. Tommy Lee Jones portrayed Clay Shaw, for those of you who might jog your memory. Clay Shaw actually owned the home where this eugenicist and his wife lived, and that address, those phone numbers, were in Lee Harvey Oswald's address book. Why? To this day, we don't know. But here we have a eugenicist with the name Klepfer, obviously of German extraction. We have Dan Burroughs, and we have the American Nazi Party. We have German vocabulary listed in his address book. We have a lot of very tantalizing clues that there was something involving the extreme right. By extreme right, let's put the name to it, the Nazi right in the United States. Nazis, neo-Nazis, if you like that term, and Lee Harvey Oswald. There are more references to Nazis and to Germany, you might say, in his address book than there might be to communists. There was a definite focus by Oswald on this. Now, was this in what was this in aid of? Was he doing some sort of strange surveillance of the Nazis? That doesn't seem likely. His friends happened to have been the people like George de Morenschild and the white Russians around him. The people that he befriended in Texas were anti-communist Russians, not communists. He didn't really, Lee Harvey Oswald did not really defend Moscow or communism that much to the people that he met. The reason why he came back from the Soviet Union was because he was disillusioned, according to him, by the communist experiment there, and now was involved with a different kind of people for different purposes. We can bring up the fact that he tried to get to Cuba and all the rest of it. What did all of that mean? If it's just that we're talking about Lee Harvey Oswald as a kind of lone gunman, then nothing that he does could make any sense. It's all of a piece with some sort of insane rambling, like a schizophrenic muttering to himself, the actions that he took. However, there seems to be much more of a mechanism behind all of this. The trip ostensibly to Albert Schweitzer College is part of that. Schweitzer College was run by a group of Unitarians. One of the Unitarians involved in Schweitzer College was also a member of the organization Project Hope. Project Hope, of course, was what gave us the ship Project Hope that went to Indonesia in the 1960s in order to provide medical treatments and medical training to indigenous medical personnel in Indonesia. This has connections back to our story, which we'll get into in a bit. But also, the Albert Schweitzer College Board of Directors was also involved with the ICA, which was this strange organization set up by John Foster Dulles, which was the forerunner of the USAID program, USAID program, which was designed to provide aid to developing nations, except that it didn't always do that. George de Morenschild, the friend of Lee Harvey Oswald, wound up in Yugoslavia as part of ICA, which was a State Department organization. And he was there at one point of being arrested by the Yugoslavian authorities for espionage. ICA also shows up in the stories we have to tell of Indonesia and Yorgan Tanpuk, a doctor who was once believed to, or maybe is still believed to have been actually Adolf Hitler in disguise. So we have a lot of information surrounding Lee Harvey Oswald in this case, his connections to intelligence types, to military people, and to the extreme right, to the Nazi underground, are not just tenuous, they're actually quite strong, and they are disturbing, to say the least.
You mentioned the American Nazi Party, returning again briefly to Oswald in New Orleans, and according to Delphine Roberts, her Guy Bannister's secretary, and to Jack Martin, Guy Bannister himself was connected to the American Nazi Party. I wonder if you would briefly fill us in on that.
Well, certainly. I mean, Delphine Roberts herself was a rabid anti-Semite and a pro-Nazi activist. I mean, she would lead protests on street corners and set up stalls and everything else, talking about white power and all sorts of racist stuff of that nature. And according to her and to Jack Martin, Guy Bannister was, you know, a part of that milieu. He received the mailings from the American Nazi Party. He was on their mailing list. He helped when people were being arrested to get them out of jail. At one point, I believe it was he raised money to help George Lincoln Rockwell when Rockwell was protesting against the movie Exodus. When it was being filmed. I mean, Guy Bannister was very involved with the American Nazi Party, and he put his money where his mouth was. He made contributions. He was politically active with them. And, of course, we have Lee Harvey Oswald, you know, operating out of Guy Bannister's office in New Orleans. I mean, if you wanted one more, just one more little push in this direction, it's the fact that Marguerite Oswald, Lee Harvey Oswald's mother, was represented by a man called H. Keith Thompson as her literary agent and to help her as the executor of her estate. H. Keith Thompson, we've mentioned briefly in the past, was a member, of course, was a Nazi, was a dedicated Nazi. He had joined the Secret Service, the Nazi Secret Service, in 1941. He received some sort of award from Himmler that he bragged about. He was very much involved with Nazism before the war. During the war, he was actually in the U.S. Navy and served with Operation High Jump in Antarctica. Talk about a treasure trove for all sorts of speculation. And then after that, he was extremely prominent in the Nazi underground in the United States. Very, very active in the Nazi underground. Worked with SS General Otto Remer, whom we mentioned previously. Otto Remer was the man who was responsible for uncovering the Valkyrie plot to assassinate Hitler, to round up all the co-conspirators and have them executed. Remer would then go on to become prominent in Austrian politics in his attempt to create an Austrian Nazi party after the war. He then became very involved on and off with American politics. He became involved with the Liberty Lobby, with Cardo, and with all of that was going on at the time as far as an extreme right alliance with Nazi celebrities, let's put it that way. H. Keith Thompson was also a major contributor to Pat Buchanan's political aspirations. Pat Buchanan, as you may remember, was Richard Nixon's speechwriter and the man who convinced, President Nixon's speechwriter, but also he worked for President Reagan and advised Reagan to lay a wreath at the Bitburg Cemetery, at the SS Cemetery, this very controversial act of Reagan laying a wreath at a tombstone honoring the SS, because Pat Buchanan said, well, they suffered too. This was the kind of a person H. Keith Thompson was. Thompson was involved with all of these individuals. There's a very clear worldview there, which is anti-Semitic and pro-Nazi. And here we have H. Keith Thompson, this man who was involved with everyone from James Madole that I mentioned to the American Nazi Party, George Lincoln Rockwell, Van Burroughs, the list goes on and on, Hans Ulrich Rudel, Otto Skorzeny, Leon de Grel, and the former Belgian fascist. Here is a man involved with all of these people whose entire occupation seems to be promoting the Nazi ideal, who then becomes Lee Harvey Oswald's mother's literary agent.
It doesn't sound particularly communist to me. I mean, but then who am I, right? Obviously, I'm being sarcastic. It is, you know, last week we were talking briefly about guilt by association. And this, once again, I think would be association by guilt, because what we're looking at is something that on its surface makes no sense. No way is a Marine going to defect to the Soviet Union with information about our radar nets and then come home, not be prosecuted, be met by Spaz Rakin, the Secretary General of the American Friends of the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, and then begin hanging out with Nazis and white Russians. There's a lot of overlap there. It just makes no sense at all. It is a tremendous discontinuity or incongruity. Peter, you write at length about some of the perilous waters that are to be found in the tributaries running into and out of the Revolutionary Fund of Sukarno. I wonder if you would briefly encapsulate the history of, first of all, the Golden Lily program that we spoke about with the Seagraves, how that impinges on Indonesia, how Hjalmar Schacht and the Islamic Crescent proposed by both Willoughby and Schacht figure into this, and then detail for us, or to the extent that we have time to do it, a remarkable series of characters, enigmatic up to a point, and yet people whose activities turned out to be quite lethal, often for them. Talking about Dr. Polk, the mysterious Dr. Polk and his wife, Mr. Garitno, Dr. Susuro Husudo, and some others. Why don't we start with Golden Lily and the Seagraves?
Certainly. Of course, the Seagraves have done us a tremendous service by doing the kind of research that that only they can do. For the most part, Americans are not too familiar with what goes on in Asia. It's all one sort of block to them. They can't tell the histories apart, Japan, China, Philippines, all the rest of it, Korea, Taiwan, and so on and so forth. It's kind of an entirely separate kind of cultural environment. We're kind of used to Europe to a certain extent, but when it comes to Asia, it's sort of terra incognita. And the Seagraves have done a remarkable service in going back and looking specifically at the dynasties that were so powerful in Asia, and in books like Yamashita's Gold and the Gold Warriors, what they've done is open the light and shine a very bright light on something that our American political leaders have chosen to forget, which is the extent to which Japan in the 1930s and 40s raided the coffers of all of Asia, whatever country they happened to have invaded. Like the Nazis, they would go into the banks, into the museums, into private homes, and take anything that was valuable. This included enormous quantities of gold, jewelry, artworks, priceless texts, statuary, all sorts of things that still have not been recovered, a lot of which still is in Japanese hands, but then a lot of it which was buried throughout the islands in Southeast Asia. As we know, Japan took large chunks of Southeast Asia in 1941 after they had invaded China and Taiwan. There was the invasion of Malaya, Singapore, Indonesia, and the Philippines. In doing this, of course, as I said, they took possession of all those countries' material wealth, whatever it could be lifted and carried away was. And then they proceeded to exploit, of course, the natural resources, oil, rubber, tungsten, whatever else was available in those parts of the world they were extracting to help support the war effort. But by 1944, in Asia, as it was in Germany, the handwriting was on the wall. Intelligent people could see that the tide of war would turn against them. And it was up to the leaders, military leaders in both spheres, in both political theaters, to decide what they were going to do with all of the ill-gotten gains, all of the wealth that they had accumulated. The Seagraves demonstrate sort of page by page and footnote by footnote what happened to that money in Asia. There was a general, Yamashita, who then was in charge of hiding as much of those valuables as he possibly could. And that meant digging caves, digging the holes in the ground, burying the gold wherever it could be found in the Philippines, either in the islands themselves, in various cave complexes, or simply burying it in the sides of mountains or under the earth, in the cities in the Philippines, using the Catholic Church cooperation as part of what they were up to, burying gold in church buildings and property owned by the church in various places, but for the most part also in caves, not just in the Philippines, but also in the Indonesian archipelago, in those remote islands such as Papua New Guinea, such as Timor, Sumbawa, and all those remote places. We have military records showing that submarine activity, Japanese submarine activity, extended well after the end of the war in Europe. In May of 45, there were Japanese troops being stationed in various islands in the archipelago. We don't know what for, stationed there, and then a month or so later picked up and taken away. We believe, or I believe, and I think the Seagraves are of the opinion as well, I don't want to put words in their mouth, but that the Japanese troops were involved in hiding this treasure, very little of which ever came to light. This money, what was retrieved, and some of it was retrieved under torture, by the way, from the people who had buried it. Some of this money was used to finance extreme right parties in Japan, nationalist parties in Japan after the war. General Willoughby, who we spoke about previously, was involved in handling these finances, in moving this money abroad. When Nixon became president, he cut some kind of a deal with the Japanese government in exchange for their opposition to communism on the mainland in China and in Vietnam and Southeast Asia, to surrender some of that money, surrender some of the gold that they had acquired, the M Fund, as it was known. So there's a lot of dark and deep machinations going on where the Golden Lily gold, as it was called, we can call it Golden Lily, we can call it the Black Eagle Trust, we can call it Yamashita's gold, we can call it the M Fund. These are all terms referring to various aspects of this hidden treasure.
I guess we could call this Associations by Guilt.
Yes, Associations by Guilt, exactly. And this money, of course, has its own life. Gold is not traceable. You know, you melt down a gold bar and no one knows where that gold came from. It would take a very expensive assayist to try to find out how much of that gold might have been sourced in Europe, might have been sourced someplace else. That's always been rather unsuccessful. So gold is the perfect commodity. Everyone knows what it is. They know what the value is. And moving the gold around is better than paper currency or anything else. So the gold was very, very beneficial to all of these countries and individuals and organizations that used it as part of their slush fund. This leads us then into Hjalmar Schacht in the 1950s. Schacht, of course, was aware that the Nazis had secreted vast quantities of gold. A lot of it wound up in Switzerland, but as we mentioned, a lot of it wound up in Asia as well as in South America. Schacht would have known about this. He became an advisor to President Sukarno in 1950-51, shortly after the end of the war. And there he is advising Sukarno on what to do and explaining to Sukarno that he should create the Revolutionary Fund. He should create an independent fund to finance his operations and to form a kind of Islamic crescent, a caliphate, that would stretch from Southeast Asia throughout Indonesia and to act as a buffer against China. Schacht was actually essentially doing in 1951 what he had been doing in 1941. He was understanding that the conflicts would be between the United States and the Soviet Union, the United States and communism in general, and he was advising a third way, a third approach, as he did to Hitler, as he did to the fascists in Europe, and as he was now doing to Sukarno, who he believed was a fascist because of Sukarno's speeches against the United States during World War II, because of his broadcasts from Japan in favor of the Japanese invasion of Indonesia. Schacht believed he was talking to someone he could deal with. And shortly thereafter, Sukarno comes up with this idea of the Revolutionary Fund. Where was Sukarno going to get money for a Revolutionary Fund? The Japanese were very slow in paying war reparations, as everybody was. And the war reparations they did pay were a drop in the bucket compared to what they had stolen out of Indonesia, as an example. Sukarno knew he had access to funds from somewhere else. We know, as we mentioned previously, of at least 20 tons of gold, Nazi gold, Black Eagle gold, that came out of Portugal, out of the Portuguese banks that went to Macau and then went to Indonesia. We know this gold existed. It's documented. It's part of the New York Times history. So what was really going on? What did Sukarno know? How much gold did Sukarno have access to? This is what gave rise to the idea of a revolutionary fund, a rival to the International Monetary Fund, a rival to the World Bank, which is what all the non-aligned nations wanted, because the World Bank was dictating terms to them. They were dictating terms of how they should conduct their internal affairs, how they should develop their own economies, all of these things in return for the investments that the IMF was going to make. This was going to destabilize these regimes considerably, as they had done in Indonesia and in other countries, by forcing farmers to grow plants they didn't want to grow, by forcing them to export crops they didn't want to export, by bringing in Monsanto as an example, all these other things that were part and parcel of the loans the IMF would make. The people were rejecting this. Sukarno understood that. And having his own source of income, his own gold treasury, was going to make him independent. And the last thing the Western powers wanted was an independent Indonesia.
The exploration of Sukarno's gold, which certainly the Revolutionary Fund appears to have been a real thing, and yet when people like Tommy Lee Buckley, and again, the mysterious cast of characters, Dr. Husado, Sorrentino Garitano, or Sorrio Garitano, and the Pokes and others, when one begins to explore the Revolutionary Fund, rather like what happened to people who tried to explore some of the gold certificates related to the Philippines Golden Lily cashers,
sure.
Let's just say that their credit ratings took a huge drop for no good reason.
Yeah. This is one of the most bizarre episodes in history that I've ever come across, and I've come across some really bizarre stuff. But when we talk about the gold certificates and the internet and the Revolutionary Fund and all of this, we are truly in the twilight zone here, because none of it makes any sense. People assume that it's some kind of hoax, but as we will discover, and as I talk about in the book, this is an extremely bizarre and complicated hoax, which actually in the end nets no one anything. And it gives the lie to this idea that it's a hoax. There's something very genuine taking place here. What we have are these gold certificates, as you mentioned. This goes back now to the Revolutionary Fund, when we're talking about Indonesia specifically. And the Revolutionary Fund did exist. It was recorded in the newspapers in Singapore and in Malaysia and Indonesia at the time. Government officials who have been part of Sukarno's government admitted it existed. The leader of Golkar, the strongest political party in Indonesia at the time, also admitted it existed. Everybody knew this fund existed. They just didn't know where it was. They didn't know how they could get their hands on the gold. This has been part of the mystery concerning this, because the only evidence we have are the gold certificates. Now, the gold certificates are elaborate devices. These are instruments that are beautifully printed on heavy paper, multicolored, with all sorts of banking information printed on them. They are they're things that you would want to frame, if nothing else, because they're done so well. The printing jobs are extremely expensive. Everything is perfect, except for the names of the beneficiaries. This is one of the things that is a hallmark of the gold certificates. All these certificates are meticulously printed, except for the fact that the names of the beneficiaries are almost always, if not always, misspelled in some way. This is something that's consistent from certificate to certificate. No one understands what that means. How could you be so careful in printing such an elaborate certificate and then screw up the name of the beneficiary to the point where nobody believes it's genuine? This actually was part of the way of verifying the certificate was genuine, because a forgery would not make that mistake. Only someone deliberately making these mistakes could be assumed to have access to the gold represented by the certificates. This was part of the idea. Make the most obvious mistake in the name of the beneficiary, as long as everything else is okay. But what does a gold certificate mean? The certificates are in enormous sums of money. We're talking about millions of dollars of gold for each certificate, sometimes tens of millions of dollars of gold for each certificate. And the certificates are drawn, or not drawn, but they're represented by specific banks, banks in Europe for the most part. So what happens is you have the certificate. It seems to be a legitimate document, a legitimate instrument that says that the bearer of this certificate has access to this gold, which is held in the account for, let's say, President Sukarno of Indonesia. Fine. So you take the certificate, and you go to the bank with the certificate, and you say, what can I do with this certificate? And once you do that, you are promptly arrested. You're arrested for forgery. You're arrested for fraud. You're arrested for all sorts of things that you have absolutely no history of doing, and yet because the mere fact that you own that certificate indicates that you're involved in some criminal activity. This is a way for the banks to protect themselves against someone showing up and asking to draw out $10 million worth of gold. $10 million worth at the time that certificate was drawn up, at that date, which we could consider to be a different valuation today. So if everybody were to actually try to exchange these certificates for gold, it would cause a tremendous drop in the value of gold in the worldwide markets and possibly cause an economic collapse. And yet these certificates exist. Some of these certificates were in the possession of a man called Damanik. Damanik was an Indonesian. He was a prominent Indonesian member of the government at one point. I think he was a police officer, a police inspector, a higher-ranking officer in the police. His name was Dr. Damanik. And he was on the board of a bank called Galaxy Trust in Jakarta. Well, he came in contact, and in possession, I should say, with some of these certificates. And he tried to negotiate them in the United States. He went to the United States. He went to the Federal Reserve Bank. And he simply asked this honest question, what should I do with this certificate? What is this? And they arrested him. They threw him in jail. He stayed in jail for a while. He was released without comment. He was arrested on very ambiguous and vague charges. He went back to Indonesia and promptly died. Tommy Lee Buckley, as you mentioned, another person with the certificates that Damanik was trying to negotiate, then goes and tries to negotiate them. He goes to a bank in the United States, innocently asking what he should do with the certificate. He is then arrested. He's being charged with fraud. He's being charged with forgery, all of these things. Obviously, he didn't forge the certificates. He got them from Damanik. He was trying to negotiate them in good faith, or at least find out about them in good faith. He was denied the ability to do anything with these certificates. He began to try to raise money and raise consciousness through the Internet and things like that. He was then charged with committing fraud over the Internet because he was trying to raise money for his defense fund and was trying to really figure out what these certificates were worth. This was an honest attempt at understanding this, because you're holding in your hand a piece of paper that looks extremely official, which says it's referring to gold certificates, which are supposedly on the account of people like President Sukarno, of Saddam Hussein, of Muammar Gaddafi, of various American political leaders as well. I mean, also the Queen of England. All these, you know, certificates have all these various names on them, one by one. Of course, you want to know what to do with it. You're not going to throw it out in the trash. You're going to see what the value is. And Tommy Buckley tried to do that when he went to court finally and was considered he was going to be guilty of fraud. He was going to be sentenced. He committed suicide and died, took his own life because he couldn't deal with what was going on around him. Damanik, of course, as we said, died kind of mysteriously upon his return to Indonesia. Tommy Lee Buckley died. There was an Australian, or a New Zealander rather, who tried to find out what to do with these certificates. He brought them to a bank for safekeeping only. He was not trying to negotiate them or do anything with them, but by simply walking into the bank with that certificate, he basically signed his arrest warrant. He was arrested and thrown in jail for even just having possession of the certificates. So this is something that's extremely bizarre. I can't quite get my head around it. It is something that that is prominent in the news from time to time in Indonesia. The Sukarno family is very aware of this. They don't know what to make of it either. They know that the Revolutionary Fund exists. They know all of this is true. They have no idea about the certificates, or at least they're not telling us if they do. And it's Damanik's bank, Galaxy Trust, PT Galaxy Trust, that gets us back into the story of Georg Anton Puch, that gets us into the story of a very mysterious doctor and his wife who wind up in Indonesia in the 1950s as part of ICA, they claim, to at least one interviewer, and the wife disappears out of Indonesia, goes back to Europe, and Puk himself dies mysteriously in the city of Surabaya, which, as we recall, is the location of Walter Huell, Surabaya Wali. He dies in Surabaya in 1970, having been summoned there for a mysterious meeting that we don't know if he ever made it, but he died and was buried in Surabaya. I actually went to the grave of this German who was involved, at least peripherally, in the Revolutionary Fund, in the Golden Lily, Black Eagle Trust money, and all the rest of it. Do we have time to get into that, is my question.
Probably not past the point. We've got about 9 minutes left. You might want to briefly mention, though, what allegations were contained about Dr. Puk in the book, I believe it was written by or generated by Dr. Husado, and perhaps preface that when we talk about Adolf Hitler and his escape after the war, that is a subject that will incline the layperson to say to themselves, boy, Hitler escaped, well, that guy's off his meds. And then publicly they'll say, I'm sorry, Sonny, we're all out of candy. And yet a Russian pathologist, former Soviet pathologist, has disclosed information that would indicate that whether or not the allegations in Dr. Husado's book are correct, certainly the official version of Hitler's, quote, death, unquote, is just not true.
Yes. I mean, my previous book to this, Ratline, covered that in some detail because I had come across this story when I was in Indonesia back in 2007, I believe it was, and someone had told me the story of Hitler having escaped to Indonesia, living on this remote island, and my reaction was exactly what you described. I'm sorry, you're off your meds and we're all out of candy. But I was forced to look at it a bit more deeply because I had known one of my acquaintances over the years has been Dr. Nicholas Bellantoni, who was the chief archaeologist of the state of Connecticut. We had crossed paths earlier on a different kind of project, and Bellantoni actually went to Moscow to investigate the skull that the Russians had and found that it was not Hitler's skull. It was not even the skull of a man. It was all totally wrong. And that opened up this whole can of worms that did Hitler die in the bunker or not? I mean, where's the forensic evidence? I mentioned Dr. Georg Puk, Anton Puk, a Nazi. There was a Georg, Anton Puk, who was chief medical officer in Salzburg for the Nazis. I saw his handwritten testament. I saw an address book that he kept. I was able to see that in 2013. In the first few months of 2013, I was able to take a look at that in Singapore and to satisfy myself that it was genuine. Georg Anton Puk died, as I mentioned, in Surabaya in 1970 in January. By April 1970, the KGB had already dug up what they claimed was the body of Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun from a mysterious location in East Germany. They dug it up, burned it, and scattered the ashes to the winds, basically to a river, a tributary of the river Elbe. I look at these two events happening in such close proximity as being suggestive of some darker purpose, some darker connection. And so I started to seriously look at the fact, look at the idea that Hitler had escaped. Whether or not he made it to Indonesia at this point is immaterial, but the story of Georg Anton Puk is very, very suggestive of what went on. Here was a man who was a Nazi, who was a leading Nazi, if this was truly the man who went to Indonesia. His wife was a famous anthropologist, the chairwoman of the Viennese Anthropological Society, a very well-known woman. These two individuals, very prominent in Austrian society, friends of people like Heinrich Harrer and others, wind up in Indonesia on a remote island for the rest of their lives. It doesn't make any sense. What were they running from? What were they hiding from? So I began to research that and found out, just briefly before we run out of time, that while this couple, Georg Anton and Helena Puk, were living on Sumbawa Island, Heinrich Harrer, the very famous SS officer, an SA officer who was Hitler's favorite mountain climber, who spent 7 years with the Dalai Lama in Tibet. The same Heinrich Harrer wound up in Indonesia, on Papua New Guinea, researching Stone Age tribes, or so he claimed. No one seems to believe that. The reviews of the book that he wrote about it when it came out were extremely critical, because it seemed as though he had not really been there, or if he had been there, he was up to something else, and it wasn't anthropology by any means. So was he looking for some of that buried gold, knowing Harrer's background with the Dalai Lama, with American and other intelligence agencies during World War II and after World War II? We can surmise almost anything. But the fact that Harrer and Polk were in such close proximity at the same place at the same time begs some speculation where that's concerned. And that's a story I'm still working on, especially as a reader of my books has contacted me in the last couple of months and revealed to me something which I did not realize in my own books, and that was that Mr. Demonic's bank, the PT Galaxy Trust, so intimately involved with the Sukarno gold certificates and the Revolutionary Fund, was the same bank at which the Polks, the Georg Anton and Helen Polk couple, had accounts. And I actually mention this without realizing I'm mentioning it in both books because of certain coding systems. If you look at my website, you'll see what I mean. But it took one of my readers in Europe to actually decode the code that I had was struggling with, and showed me that as early as the 1950s or 1960s, Georg Anton Polk and his wife Helen had bank accounts at this obscure, virtually non-existent bank in Jakarta. This seems to indicate that there was a gold rush taking place. Harrer might have been part of it. The Polks might have been part of it. Sukarno was definitely involved. And remember, Polk was extremely, as a Nazi, would have been extremely anti-communist, and indeed actually visited the island of Bali at the time when there was a tremendous massacre of so-called alleged communists taking place on that island during the Year of Living Dangerously. So I'll have to leave you with that, I suppose, as something to think about.
And we should mention, too, that Mr. Gritno, I may not be pronouncing that name right, when he began looking into this, he went to Moscow. And this guy is a professional arms dealer, so somebody who you would assume had his security ducks in a row. And he goes to Moscow and then comes back and is hit by some sort of seizure or stroke that enable that keeps him from communicating or acting at all. Basically, he's a basket case at this point. So perhaps we can explore that more in our next talk, but we are almost out of time. Again, I recommend to both newer listeners and in particular for veteran listeners who've been with me for these decades, there has never been a single book with more of the things that I talk about between the covers, and I emphatically encourage listeners to get a hold of the book, talk about it, turn other people onto it. People say, well, I believe what you're talking about, but I don't know what to do about it. This is something that is altogether doable, and again, I have no financial stake in this. Peter, where can people get the book?
Yes, as you mentioned at the top of the show, The Usual Suspects. You can get it, of course, on Amazon.com, and Barnes & Noble has been carrying it in some of their stores as well.
So that is where people can go, and I very, very strongly recommend that they go out and pick up Hitler's Legacy and pick a look at what is going on in the world around them today, and perhaps get a handle on the nature of contemporary political reality. This concludes For the Record program number 845, interview number 8 with Peter Lavenda about the Hitler Legacy. For Peter Lavenda, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening. This is being recorded on April 26th of the year 2015.